DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Dr. James Hitchcock, who is a noted historian and longtime professor at St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Hitchcock has written numerous journal articles, and his books include The Supreme Court and Religion in American Life, The Recovery of the Sacred, What is Secular Humanism, Why Humanism Became Secular and How It's Changing Our World, and Catholicism and Modernity, Confrontation or Capitalization. With Dr. James Hitchcock, we go inside the pages of History of the Catholic Church, from the Apostolic Age to the Third Millennium, published by Ignatius Press. Dr. Hitchcock, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very glad to be here.
What an extraordinary work. I just think it's so necessary right now, the history of the Catholic Church, and it's the format of it makes it so digestible, even for someone like me. It's absolutely phenomenal. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I put a lot of work in on it, I'll have to say that.
What motivated you to undertake such a large process?
Well, the short motivation was that the publisher urged me to do it. But as I thought about it, I've read and studied and taught about Catholic Church history for all my life. That's not my only field, but it has been one of them. And I thought, well, I probably know about as much about this as anybody does right now. And actually, as I also thought about it, I didn't think there was any single one-volume history of the Church now available that I would willingly recommend. So for those reasons, I went ahead and did it.
Well, we're certainly glad you did. I mean, the overview of history that you've presented to us of the Catholic Church is an extraordinary one. Why has it been either misrepresented or distorted over time?
Well, there are different reasons. There's certainly throughout history been a great deal of, especially in modern times, a great deal of hostility to the Church from secular sources or even earlier from some Protestant sources. And this, needless to say, leads to some distorted history. So people who want to approach the entire history of the Church in terms of things like the Inquisition or, you know, featuring the bad pope, so to speak, as though they're sort of typical of the papacy. And it can be distortion also from the other side. That is, there has been apologetic Catholic history that tries to skate over problems or minimize problems or even deny them, and that's been a difficulty as well.
I think it was Flannery O'Connor who had said at one point, "We don't make the Church holy; it's Jesus in the center that makes it holy."
Absolutely, we have to always make that distinction. The Church itself is the spotless bride of Christ, but there is an immense amount of sin that is to be discerned in the Church because of the people who make it up.
Well, what's wonderful about it, right off the bat, you connect us with our roots in Jerusalem, that early Church. What in that particular era would you say a lot of people in our time don't fully appreciate?
Well, I think that the big problem there in our time has been the historical critical method, which I refer to, which sets out in a way, I think it set out in the beginning to just try to be as honest as possible, but the way it evolved was to treat everything in the Bible and in the early history of the Church with skepticism. Oh, that couldn't really have happened. You see, that was they made that story up later to justify what they were doing. And I think that we have a lot of information from the Bible, especially from the Acts of the Apostles, that tell us how the Church came into being in this world with the powerful descent of the Holy Spirit on Pentecost. There's no way, it seems to me, in human terms, that one could explain how a small group of people, frightened, hiding out in the upper room, not knowing what to do, suddenly went forth and they began to convert the world. And even within the scope of the Acts of the Apostles, which, you know, only takes in a few decades, significant conversions are taking place. And I don't think you can just explain that as some kind of well-organized human activity.
Another aspect of this book that is so, I think, extraordinary in its presentation is how you address how the different heresies crept into the church. But instead of making it, dare I say it, a dry read, you make it so accessible so that we all can understand and even recognize those heresies today, even something like Gnosticism.
Yes, exactly. I tried to do that. There is a tendency, you know, which, and I think this has got something to do with the way some of us were taught. These are kind of abstract controversies between theologians or scholars, and, well, you have to know about them. But the fact of the matter is that these movements were dynamic. They had large followings. They tore societies apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people literally fighting over some of these issues, which is not exactly a very Christian thing to do, but it shows how seriously they took it and that they understood that a heresy is a very dangerous thing because it has the potential to kill the soul. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think today we tend to see, well, you know, these are just kind of old disputes in books.
It's wonderful how you've also brought in the patristics, the writings of the church fathers.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, the fathers of the church, I fear that many Catholics today would not even necessarily recognize the term. Who are the fathers of the church? The great theologians of the first four or five centuries, Augustine probably the best known, but many others, who combined great holiness with an immense amount of learning. And they not only were learned in the scriptures and in the things of God, but they were also learned in secular things. They knew the ancient philosophers, for example. And so this is an incredible intellectual and spiritual achievement in these first four centuries, which is the basic foundation of all of subsequent Catholic belief. Vatican II, I mean, the renewal of that has been going on, as you say, for a century or more. Vatican II tried to really bring that into the forefront. I talk in the last chapter about what was called ressourcement. Let's go back to the sources. Mm-hmm. Father Ratzinger, now the Pope, of course, was very much involved in that, recognizing what immense riches are found in the writings of the fathers of the Church and how we had drifted away from that in certain important ways.
I have to tell you that the whole section on Constantine was, I thought, one of the best, so giving us historical fact, but not diminishing the value of, as you put it, the imperfect conversion.
Well, thank you. Yes, the whole story of Constantine is, in a way, you might say, an exemplar of the problem. That is, a man who in his way is devout, who is a believer in his way, wants to do the right thing, doesn't fully understand what he's doing, mm-hmm. And remains very, very much a sinner. Constantine is not a saintly individual, and he has a tremendous impact upon the history of the church, and at the same time, he's a very, very flawed individual, rather reminiscent, let's say, of the kings of Israel with David and Solomon, who were not necessarily always good men, but who had who were instruments of divine providence.
Recently, I saw on a popular cable television channel, they were trying to put human history in almost 10-minute sound bites, which in itself is impossible. But what they did is they took that particular era, especially of the Middle Ages, and beginning with the fall of Rome, and tried to attribute all of the success and all the learning and all of the achievements attributable to the Moors in Spain, as opposed to even mentioning the rise of monasticism and the influence of the Benedictines.
I didn't see that, but it doesn't surprise me. And of course, as you know, well, there's two motives behind this. One, of course, is what someone has aptly called Christophobia, the fear or hatred of Christians, which is endemic in our world. And the second thing is, of course, that it's politically correct to be pro-Islam. And so those two things come together. This is particularly ironic, as you know, mm-hmm. in that the take on the Catholic Church is, well, throughout history it's been an instrument of tyranny and oppression and torture and one thing and war. Well, Islam, to the degree that that's true of the Catholic Church, it's even more true of Islam. And yet somehow they escape, because today the atmosphere of political correctness is against it. And, of course, it's a stick, convenient stick with which to beat Christianity.
Talk to us about the influence of Augustine.
Well, Augustine, first of all, it's a very dramatic personal story. I think that you understand a lot about what it means to be a Christian by reading his confessions and the great struggle he had to overcome his sins and the central reality of the perverted human will, so that he knew what was right but could not or would not do it. And so it's a tremendously inspiring story which could be a model for all other Christians. But Augustine was this incredibly learned man, and he had to struggle, I think, against a tendency to want to radically separate the spiritual from the temporal. He was, because of his own sinfulness, he was drawn to kind of reject the flesh, but he struggled and he was able to understand the meaning of the incarnation, that Jesus had entered into history, Jesus had entered into the flesh was good, it had to be controlled by the Spirit, it had to be governed by the Spirit, but it was fundamentally good. His book, The City of God, is for the Christians who now are going to be living in the world. They're not just waiting quickly to be carried up to heaven, but they're going to be living in the world. They have to take responsibility for the world. And The City of God is a lengthy discussion of how the Christian takes responsibility for the world, how this world relates to the next world. And Augustine went on to write treatises on every aspect of theology, on the Trinity, on the Eucharist, on the sacraments, on the nature of God. And so we have this immense body of writing, of doctrine, and every later Christian, and this includes Protestants, are deeply indebted to Augustine. And without him, it's hard to imagine how we would be understanding our faith.
It would be in this period, as Christendom really begins to thrive and it is allowed to be able to evangelize, that you have these encounters with a more sophisticated, can I say it again, isms, all of the different things that would try to creep into the life of the church.
Yes. Evangelization, historically, is really of two different kinds. One is the sophisticated kind that you mentioned. Augustine was able to make Christianity credible to highly learned and maybe even skeptical people. And this was enormously important, because the intellectual life of the church, as formed by the fathers of the church, commanded respect. That they were able to talk to highly educated, sophisticated people. But there's another kind of evangelization forced by history, and I dare say it probably means most of our own ancestors. If you're Irish or German or French or Spanish, whatever, these were the so-called barbarian tribes, and these people weren't intellectually sophisticated. They didn't have a rich philosophy. They believed in various gods, but they didn't have really much of a theology. So they had to be evangelized in a kind of a different way. And it was part of the genius of the church that it was able to do both, and to do it very successfully.
Dr. Hitchcock, could you talk to us about the rise of the papacy? Help those Catholics who are engaged in the conversations with family but aren't even really sure themselves how to describe the importance of that particular role in the church.
Right. Well, we have to understand that there's a lot of things in the early history of the church which we don't know about. The most interesting example to me is the book, The Acts of the Apostles, in which most of the apostles are not even mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then the book ends abruptly, right in the middle, or so it seems, as Paul has been arrested and is going to be sent off to the emperor, and then the whole thing breaks off. So there's a lot of things we would like to know which we don't have answers for. And as I said in my introduction, I think the weakest argument historically is the argument for silence, you know, where someone says, well, there's no mention of that here, so it can't possibly have happened. Well, that's not a very logical argument. We know that Jesus designated Peter to be the chief of the apostles. There's a very ancient tradition, which I think almost no one today would deny, maybe there are some, that Peter did eventually go to Rome, that he was martyred there, that from a very early time, the church at Rome looked to Peter as having been its head, its bishop, and that other churches in other places always looked to Rome for leadership. We find examples of that among the Corinthians and many others who looked to Rome for leadership. Now, it did not function the way it does in the modern world, in which the Pope is the head of a large bureaucracy, in which there's a network of communication all over the world. Travel and communication was slow in those days, of course, but always the lodestar of Rome was kept in view, and other churches to some degree would try to measure themselves against Rome. And an interesting fact, which seems to prove almost the opposite of what it looks like, the popes did not attend the famous early councils like Nicaea and so forth. Well, why not? Well, first of all, it was primarily the Easterners who went, because that's where the councils took place, and also it was in the East that all these theological disputes erupted. But another fact is the Pope, like in a sense, was remaining aloof. He wasn't just another bishop like the others. And after these councils would issue their decrees, the Pope would then ratify these decrees. And there was a famous cry at one of the councils, Rome has spoken, because the issue is finished now. And as time went on, popes were able to solidify their governing structure and put into place mechanisms for communication and the actual functioning authority of the Pope within the church becomes greater and greater.
This is an extraordinary work. We're talking with Dr. James Hitchcock about the history of the Catholic Church from the Apostolic Age to the third millennium. And we cannot even begin to touch the tip of the iceberg, which is contained in this wonderful work for us in this brief time that we have together. But Dr. Hitchcock, I just to let everyone out there know, almost, if not every paragraph, has a side note to it that makes it so easy to, how can I say it, to digest all of this work.
Well, thank you. I had mixed feelings about that. I thought, well, the side notes on the one hand maybe interrupt the flow of the reading, but on the other hand, I think you're right. It does make it easier to digest it.
Yeah, and to be able to go to those different places, because there's a particular period that I'm always fascinated with, and that's that period around the 13th century.
Mm-hmm.
And because so much was happening at the church in that particular era.
Yes. Well, there was a book written many years ago called The 13th, The Greatest of the Centuries, written from a Catholic point of view. I think that, too, the whole idea of Christendom, which culminates in the 13th century, is a perfect illustration, again, of what you might call the ambiguity or the irony, let's say, of the history of the church. In some ways, that was the most Catholic century, because the faith permeated everything. Mm-hmm. You really literally couldn't go out your front door and walk down the street without being reminded in some very vivid way of your religion. The calendar was organized that way. Their economic life through the guilds was organized along religious lines. There was monasteries and convents were everywhere. Churches were everywhere. You heard the church bells. There was clear-cut church teaching that guided people in every aspect of their lives. On the other hand, it was an age that was not free of sometimes brutal sinfulness. Popes, even in the 13th century, who were not great popes, not as bad as some who were some earlier and some later, but there were some who were already too much enamored of power in the 13th century. We can begin to see signs of corruption in religious life, which will become more severe as time goes on. So the 13th century is, among other things, very fascinating for that reason.
Just the saints that permeated the church at that time. I mean, you would have someone as little as Francis and
yes.
Clare, and then you would have Thomas Aquinas.
Yes, exactly. Thomas Aquinas, who along with Augustine is the greatest theologian in the history of the church, and just as everything we know about our faith comes through the prism of Augustine, so it also comes through the prism of Aquinas. And then Francis, a very different sort of person, not learned, not particularly interested in learning, but is on fire with this desire to live the life of Christ, and who served for so many people as a living example of what it meant to be a Christian. And it's a very, in the 13th century, it's getting to be very prosperous. People, you know, by our standards, many people were still extremely poor, but compared to the, what had gone before, it was a much more prosperous society. And there was necessarily, therefore, a love of riches, which is the scriptures warn against. And Francis identifies that as the crucial point. And if you can give up your attachment to worldly things, put yourself entirely in the hands of God, that's what it really means to be a Christian. Again, one of the ironies of the age, because many bishops and popes and so forth were living lives of luxury. And in a way, they thought they had to, because they thought it was commensurate with their office. You know, that, well, you have mm-hmm. a bishop living in a shack, and so on. People wouldn't respect him, but it was a difficulty that the church had to cope with.
Throughout the entire book, you also give us a sense of the transformation of the liturgy as it spread to all the different cultures and engaged the different generations that it found itself in. That, I think, just that alone could have been taken out and been a book unto itself.
Well, yes, and to tell you the truth, it is. I relied pretty heavily in a classic work that was published in the 1940s called The Mass of the Roman Rite by a German Jesuit named Jungmann. I didn't follow him in everything because some of what he said has now been revised. There have been histories of the liturgy written, and his is the best, I think, still. But as with so many other things, they tend to be written now from the post-Vatican II perspective, and often they are people, we call them liberals, who are trying to debunk, in some sense, the liturgical traditions of the church. After all, the liturgical life is at the heart of our faith, of our practice of our faith, and so I thought I had to integrate that into the ongoing historical account.
I hope you're getting the sense that I'm extraordinarily enthusiastic about this book.
I am, and I'm very, very appreciate it. And I hope all your readers will become equally enthusiastic. Up until a week before Christmas, the book had seemingly not yet appeared in the stores, but I think it was on the verge of doing so.
Well, it is. Each page is a gem, and I would encourage people to read each one very carefully. But in particular, I love the section 2 on the 1500s. There again, like the 13th century, the 1500s, and that dealing with the reformers, but then also how the Holy Spirit worked within the church and brought up some incredible saints.
Yes, that was a field of appeal in which I'm most comfortable, and that's where I've done most of my teaching. People know about Protestantism, of course, so forth, but they really, even many devout, sincere Catholics, don't know really about what we could call the Catholic Reformation, or sometimes called the Counter-Reformation. It wasn't just a case of suddenly the Protestants coming along and saying, look, you've done all these bad things, and now you better straighten out your act. But there were strong currents of spiritual revival and so on, some of which predated Martin Luther. And again, a time of great ambiguity, because you have the urge to reform, and then that something that can sometimes tip over the edge and become somewhat heretical. So it is indeed a very fascinating time.
Well, given your historical perspective, what's your view on the church today?
I think we face a grave crisis that is really different from all previous ones, because now we face the crisis of what we can just call blank unbelief. Mm-hmm. And an unbelief which is sometimes passive and indifferent, but oftentimes now also becomes hostile. That's been building up since the time of the French Revolution over 200 years ago, but for various complicated reasons, it has really erupted in our own time. When you go back to the Reformation, which was a major crisis, of course, on a grand scale, you were dealing there with people who believed in God. They believed in the authority of the Scriptures. They believed in the moral law. But now we're dealing with people who find no room in their lives for any of that. And we're seeing the devastating effects it's had in cultures that at one time, not many years ago, were considered firmly Catholic, like Ireland and Quebec, for example. And we have the stirrings of a counter-reform, if you want to call it that. I think John Paul II gave immense leadership here. Benedict gives immense leadership. We have spiritual movements in the church which are having a very good effect. I think we're finally coming to comprehend what the nature of liturgical reform was at Vatican II. It wasn't, you know, a case of balloons and banners, but it went mm-hmm. much deeper than that. But it's taken us now 50 years to begin to fully understand and implement the Second Vatican Council. We've lost an enormous number of people in the meantime, and the Benedict has announced a new evangelization, and that is the way in which the future lies. We will still have to keep, as I call it, shoveling debris mm-hmm. to get it out of the way so it doesn't interfere, but we have to concentrate primarily on the task of rebuilding. In that sense, we're in a posture like the Church of the 16th century, which had suffered very severe blows and then had to finally go through a period of recovery. But I think we do have to understand that for the foreseeable future, certainly well beyond our lifetimes, a good part of the Western world is going to be unsympathetic or actively hostile to the Church. And if there's an eventual recovery of Western civilization, it's going to take a long time. And then the corollary of that is we can look to very vital and promising forms of Catholicism in places like Africa and Asia, and the paradox whereby we then begin to rely on them for guidance after having given them guidance for so long.
Fascinating. Any final thoughts, Dr. Hitchcock?
The main purpose of studying history, I think, is to discover where you came from, because if you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going. I think we can find, well, almost any kind of situation that we deal with today, we can find examples of it in the previous history of the Church.
Beautiful. Dr. James Hitchcock, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed being here.
With Dr. James Hitchcock, we've gone inside the pages of History of the Catholic Church, from the Apostolic Age to the Third Millennium. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to DiscerningHearts.com. This has been a production of DiscerningHearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages. Insights from today's most compelling authors.